Let's turn to John chapter 11. We want to begin, we'll back up a couple of verses to verse 45. We really had gotten down through verse 46, but we'll just get a little bit of a retreat there to cover our tracks a little bit so that we know where we are. Of course, Jesus has just raised Lazarus from the dead. He has, in other gospel accounts, he raised people from the dead. There was the widow of Nain's son that he raised as well. And so there was the daughter of Jairus that he raised. So this is not the only resurrection that Jesus performed. This is not the only time he raised somebody from the dead. What is significant about Lazarus is that it was right outside Jerusalem. That many of the Jews from Jerusalem knew this family. They knew this man was dead. You know, maybe they'd heard the stories about what he'd done in other places out there among the country folk. But they've probably, many of them, figured that it was just stories and rumors and wasn't for real. But they knew Lazarus. They knew he had died. They knew he'd been buried. Some of those Jews from Jerusalem had come out to Bethany. It was just a 5-mile walk, just an hour or two walk out there. So they had come out to grieve with the family. Some of them had seen the miracle. But certainly, even beyond that, many in Jerusalem knew about this family, knew about this man, and knew the situation surrounding him being sick and him dying, and that this, apparently he was not terribly elderly and expected to die. He seemed to have died at an earlier age than was expected. And Jesus raised him, and he continued to live on for some time after that. And so they knew about this situation. And that put them in a bit of a quandary, because they could no longer just say, well, you know, there's all these stories about him, but we don't believe all that stuff. Now they knew here is a certifiable, documentable case of this guy was dead and Jesus raised him from the dead. And some of them believed because of what they had seen. Those that were with Mary and had seen what he did, many of those Jews believed in Jesus. Some of them, it wasn't that they didn't believe. They did believe, but they couldn't help but believe. I mean, they'd seen it with their own eyes. But what they did was go straight to the Pharisees to tell them what Jesus had done. And they said, well, they're just sharing the good news. No, these guys weren't sharing the good news. These guys were the rats that were ratting somebody out. These were the ones who were turning him in to the police for having done something that he shouldn't, kind of thing. Of course, he hadn't done anything that he shouldn't. But they were the ones who were tattletales. They were the ones like Doeg. Do you remember Doeg? Doeg the Edomite. Back in the time of King David, before King David, in the time of King Saul, David was still the general of Saul's army at this time, but Saul had turned against David, and David was on the run. Saul had tried to kill him, so David and some of his men took off running. And they went to the priest and talked with the priest, and the priest gave them some food, gave them the showbread. Jesus talks about that time David ate and his men ate the showbread. Well, they did that. And also, he gave him Goliath's sword, because he didn't have a sword. He had to leave in such a hurry to get away with his life that he didn't have time to take his weapons with him. So here he was running from Saul and didn't have any weapons. And so he said, hey, you got any weapons here? And he, this is a godly place. This is the tabernacle. This is not a war room. We don't have weapons. But we do have the sword of Goliath, the giant from Gath that you killed. We've got his sword. And David said, well, let me have it. I need a sword. And so he got that sword. Well, there was a fellow by the name of Doeg, D-O-E-G in the English, Doeg, who was an Edomite. An Edomite's a descendant of Esau. So he wasn't an Israelite. He was an Edomite. And he saw that take place. And you know what he did? He went and told Saul. I saw David down there talking with the priests. You know what Saul did? He went down there with his army, tried to get the priests to tell him where David and his men had gone. Priest wouldn't tell. Priest said, "Well, I thought he was your faithful servant. So I helped him because I thought he was on our side." Saul was so mad at those priests, he called on his soldiers to kill them. His soldiers weren't going to lift their hands against the priests of God. They knew better than that. So finally, he said, "Doeg, you kill them." And so Doeg killed those priests. But it's interesting that in Psalm 52, 2 through 4, in Psalm 120 in verse 2, and in Psalm 120 in verse 3, Doeg is called false, lying, and referred to as having a deceitful tongue. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because what did Doeg do? He told the truth, didn't he? I mean, he went back to Saul and said, "Saul, I saw David." Didn't he see David? Yeah, he saw David down there talking with the priests. So why does David refer to him as someone who is false, lying, and a deceitful tongue? Well, you see, the truth sometimes can be told in such a way as to deceive and as to bring harm and damage. His tongue caused harm even though it spoke the truth. We have to be aware of that. You know, we talked this morning about false teachers and how dangerous they are. But there are some who do as much damage with the truth because of the way that they tell that truth. Sometimes it's not what you say, it's how you say it. You heard that phrase before? It's not just what you say, it's how you say it. We can oftentimes say something that may, on the surface, seem quite true. But if we say it with sarcasm, then it's taken to be the opposite of that compliment. It could be an insult. We say something to somebody like, "Well, aren't you smart?" Does that mean we think they're smart? Not if we say it like that. Now, if we say, "Wow, you're smart," then they say, "Well, thank you." But if they say, "Well, aren't you smart?" And they say, "Hey, you know, you didn't have to say that about me." Well, wait a minute. Said basically the same thing. But it makes a difference how we say these things. And so it was, you know, Doeg caused problems with his tongue, and these Jews who saw what Jesus had done with this great miracle, and instead of going and telling people that might believe, and instead of believing themselves and being glad for what had happened, they went to tell the Pharisees, "You know what Jesus did this time? He went out there, he raised Lazarus from the dead." And so the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council. That's the Sanhedrin. And they said, "What are we going to do about this? What? We got to do something." And then one of the most ironic statements in all the Bible. They say, "For this man performs many signs or miracles." Out of their own mouths, they admit Jesus is performing many miracles. Now see, to the people, they say, "Oh, he's a deceiver, you know, he's a trickster," but amongst themselves, they said, "This guy is performing a lot of miracles." They all knew the truth. They all knew what he was doing. They all knew he was for real. They all knew he was performing miracles. And so they said, "Well, what are we going to do about that? If we let him go on like this, then everyone will believe in him." Well, if he's really performing all these miracles everywhere, why would it be so bad that everybody would believe in him? Wouldn't you want them to believe in him? You remember the question that some of the people asked before? Do the rulers know that this really is the Christ? Yeah, they did know. They wouldn't admit it to the people, but when they're talking amongst themselves, they know exactly what's going on here. They know he's performing these miracles, and they know if he keeps going, people are going to believe in him. And listen to what they say. Here's their excuse. People will believe it. Everyone. It's everybody's going to believe in him. Well, wouldn't that be nice? Oh, all that everyone would believe in him. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Anywhere. There's nowhere in this world that everyone believes on Jesus. But they say, if that happens, though, the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. They're worried about their position of power, and then, well, you know, we're also worried about the nation. Of course, first and foremost, our place. We won't get to be the head of the Jews' religion. We won't get all this prestige and popularity and fame and the fortune that goes along with it and all of these things. We won't get that anymore if everybody believes in him. Now, here's the ironic thing about that situation. They were so concerned that if people believed in Jesus, then the Romans would get angry and come take them. Why would they get angry? What did Jesus say? Jesus said, pay your taxes to Caesar. Jesus said, submit to the government. Jesus said, don't resist evil. Jesus didn't say anything that was threatening to the Roman government. The only thing threatening about Christianity was that they would not worship the Roman God. But that in and of itself shouldn't have even been threatening to the Roman government. It shouldn't matter to them whether the Christians worshiped their gods or not. As long as they were law-abiding citizens, what difference would it make? But the problem here is, the irony of it is, that by trying to kill him, and in fact succeeding eventually in killing him, and persecuting the Christians and those that followed Christ after his death and resurrection, by continuing that course of action, they themselves wound up, and of course continuing, instead of following Jesus' teachings of pay your taxes to Caesar, submit to the government, be obedient, be good citizens, instead of following that tack, they took the other tack, and they were very uncooperative with the government that was over them. And what happened to them? In 70 AD, the city of Jerusalem was surrounded and destroyed, wiped off the face of the map, pretty much. The very thing that they were concerned would happen if they let people believe in Jesus was the thing they brought about by not believing in him and not following his peaceful ways. They brought their own destruction on them. But verse 49 says, but one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish. Now this is some of the beauty of the workings of God right here. Caiaphas had no intention, he was not a godly man, and he had no intention of being a prophet for God. What he said here was said with very selfish motives. He just wanted to protect his position and the guys, his buddies that were hanging out there with him in the Sanhedrin. He was just saying, hey, look, we got to protect ourselves, and it's better if we just kill this guy, this Jesus, if we just kill him. Well, verse 50, though John explains, or verse 51 rather, John explains it to us. He didn't say this of his own accord, but being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. Now, he wasn't prophesying of his own volition, of his own will. Now, there are a few cases in the Bible where people prophesied when they didn't really want to. Saul was one example of that. We talked about Saul and David. Saul was on his way to go kill David on one occasion, and he got caught up in the Spirit and started prophesying. and never made it to where he was trying to go to kill David. It's kind of an odd circumstance. But then you have other people who wanted to prophesy, like Balaam. Boy, he wanted to go tell Balak how to destroy the Israelites. God would not let him say what he wanted to say. He wouldn't let him prophesy those words of doom to the Israelites because God was blessing the Israelites. Moses said, well, I can't talk good. Get somebody that can talk good. And God said, who made your tongue? I'll put the words in your mouth. I'll make it work. And God put these words that have a double meaning. Caiaphas didn't mean them in a good way. He meant that we just got to kill this guy to protect ourselves so bad things don't happen to us. But God meant them for good. That Jesus would die for that nation. And not for just the nation of physical nation of Israel, he tells us in verse 52, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. And that was what Jesus died for, was to bring all of God's children together, to all be Christians with Him. Verse 53, and we find out what kind of people these people really are. You know, I guarantee you, all of us have had somebody in our lives that we disagreed with strongly, didn't like, couldn't stand to be around, didn't want to be around that person. We've probably all had somebody like that in our lives. Hopefully they're not here with us tonight. Or if they are, hopefully we got over that part. But, you know, we've all gone through that. And these Jewish leaders were no different. They didn't like Jesus. They didn't want him. But have we ever done, I hope we haven't done what they did. From that day on, they made plans to kill him. They started planning from that very day how they were going to murder him. We find out in chapter 12, they weren't going to just try to kill him. They were going to try to kill Lazarus too. Because Lazarus was the evidence. He was the proof. If they could get rid of the proof and get rid of the man that did it, then they thought they'd be clear of the whole thing. Caiaphas was right about one thing. He says, you know nothing? Well, they didn't know nothing. They were some of the most foolish people fighting against God. And thinking that they were going to win. Thinking that they had the power to pull this all off. And it wasn't going to work out that way. Of course, Jesus knew about their plans. And verse 54 says, he no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to a region near the wilderness, to a town called Ephraim. And there he stayed with the disciples. And the Passover was at hand. This was most likely the fourth and final Passover of the time of Jesus' public ministry. He kind of started with the Passover and then went a year and had another Passover, went a year, had another Passover, went another year, and now this is the end of the third year, and here we are, another Passover, and this is going to be it. This is going to be the end of his ministry, of his life. At this Passover, as we're coming up toward the end of the book of John, heading that direction. And it says, the Passover of the Jews was at hand. Many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. It was a law with the Passover. They had to go. They had to be purified. They couldn't just show up and do it. They had to, if they had done anything unclean, if they had any sin, they had to get that cleaned up. Had to be ready to do the Passover. If they touched a dead body or any of those kind of things, they had to go to the temple and offer their sacrifices for that. And these people, they came up early and they were looking for Jesus. And they're saying, hey, what do you think? You think he's going to come to the feast? Or do you think he won't come? You think he's afraid? He won't come to the feast? Or do you think he's going to be here? They were interested in getting a chance to meet him and see him and hear him. But, verse 57, the other side of that coin. So there was people that wanted to get to see Jesus, wanted to get to hear Jesus. Wanted to get to meet him. But on the other side, the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders. Now I understand, the Sanhedrin Council, the chief priests and Pharisees, the Sanhedrin Council was a ruling authority among the Jews. It'd be like, this is kind of like saying the police had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so they could arrest him. You think there weren't some people who knew where he was? Well, the disciples certainly knew where he was. Others probably knew where he was. But they were keeping the secret. And in so doing, they were rebels. They were breaking the law of man to protect the Son of God. They weren't going to tell. They weren't going to turn him over. In fact, the fact of the matter is, when Jesus stands before Pilate, Pilate says, I can't find anything wrong with this guy. Why has he been arrested? Why is he on trial? He hadn't done anything. Why is he even here? But the chief priests and Pharisees were so set on destroying him. They threw caution to the wind, and they made it a law. If you know where he's at, you better tell us. You know, we have laws like that, that if somebody's committed a crime and you hide them, they consider you an accessory after the fact, or they consider you harboring a fugitive, or there's things, you can get arrested yourself for those kinds of things. Those that believed in Jesus took a risk by doing what they knew was right and not obeying the commands of the people that were in authority over them. We need to be sure that we have that kind of gumption, if you will, that we'd have that kind of courage to stand up and say, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to turn somebody over. I'm not going to tell them where somebody is. If somebody's a criminal, we're not talking about that though. Jesus hadn't done anything wrong. He wasn't a criminal. He hadn't done anything. Everything he'd done had been good things. Now, certainly, if we know about a criminal, we get to turn that in. But if we know somebody's not done anything wrong, why would we turn them in? Why would we do that? Well, some people would do that. We know one that did, don't we? We know Judas. He did it for money, didn't he? And sometimes they offer a reward to try to get those people that are a little greedy to come out with something. If you're here tonight and you have, maybe you've sold Jesus out in your own life. Maybe you've not denied him or turned him over to the authorities, but maybe you've just denied him in your own heart. Maybe you haven't trusted him. Maybe you haven't followed him as closely as you should. Maybe you haven't believed in him as much as you should. If you have a need to respond to God's invitation tonight for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.